Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Power of the Dog. The Green Knight and Licorice Pizza, I think, are just some of the movies we will not be discussing in the IGN UK podcast Alternative Movie and TV Awards. Ooh, 2021.
I know. I've managed to not do Licorice Pizza. Too
Six
obvious
out of 10
for me.
IGN.
Exactly. I'm not only is it too obvious for me, but B, not actually out in the UK till next year. So, you know, I'm going by the rules.
By the rules you've set, yeah, that we didn't discuss.
By the rules none of us have actually discussed.
I am joined by Simon Cardy, as you can hear, and Matt Perslow.
Hello.
We're going to run down three awards each that you won't see popping up on any of those boring, humdrum, run-of-the-mill awards that we and so many others give out at the end of every interminable year.
Best director, who cares?
Why would you care? What, no one even knows what a director does. As far as I understand, they just put their thumb and forefinger across from each other to make a little square and look through.
And
it
then go, can we do that again?
And if you're David Fincher, you do it loads, which I reckon is just, he's paid by the hour, Fincher. Fucking 90 takes, $20,000 more like Finch. I got your fucking number.
Does turn out good though, doesn't it?
It's all right. Yeah, he's pretty good. Apart from Mank, which I haven't seen, but looks boring as fuck.
I enjoyed it. That might have even won an award.
Was that last year?
That was last year. I might have even given that an alternate award last year.
You probably did. You probably did. Because you're alternative, aren't you?
Oh, I do try.
Kind of a guy.
I do
try. Like a 90s band. Right. Here's the first of many awards that we're going to give out to some of our favourite and, occasionally, most shitty things of 2021. But we're going to start positive with Matt. Matt, what you got?
I have got the Bastards I Love to Hate Award.
Oh, this was one of the awards I almost had. I'm glad taken the mantle. Yeah.
So there we go. This is, of course, to Succession, a
well
show...
Done.
That somehow seems to work incredibly, like, better each season, despite the fact I don't like a single character in the entire show. Like, I sometimes speak to people and they're like, oh, I love Tom, I love Greg, I love Logan, I love Kendall. I don't like any of these
characters. Anyone love Logan?
I hope some people do. I think they're all awful, and that's the reason why the show is brilliant, because it somehow makes the worst people in the world so compelling to watch.
It's so unbelievably good. I feel like we should actually preface this. I don't think we're going to be spoiling any TV or films here for people. So don't.
No.
I'm not anywhere in my awards. So don't worry if you haven't seen or watched any, you're planning to. Do listen to this podcast. We're not going to spoil anything for you. We're not going to spoil Succession because why would you want to? Because that season finale was unbelievably good. I didn't think like a top season 2's finale, but I think they may have done it.
I think they did. I also think the interesting thing about this series is I actually started more downbeat on it than I have, you know, relatively speaking, than any other Succession. I was like, oh, the single plot line element where everyone's working towards one thing just felt much less interesting than how Succession had worked as like this grand, like horrific soap opera for a few seasons. And then they just deal with it, like without giving stuff away. They just... they change that plot line completely into something that you were never expecting. And then, like you said just before we started, those last three episodes of this season are among like some of the best, like,
they're just
mini arcs
aping
of TV
the Godfather. And what more do you want from anything? I mean, like, and you say they're the most despicable bastards. I can't remember what the exact phrasing of this award was. It was something along those lines. I agree, but they also do this thing. Like, Jesse Armstrong, the creator, is just a genius. He does those, like, from episode to episode, you do kind of think maybe these people aren't too bad. Like, there's points in this show, like the first few episodes, Roman, I was like, oh, maybe he isn't. Maybe he is a bit human compared to the rest. Then halfway through that season, you're just like, oh, no, he's awful.
he's an actual fascist.
The thing I really like about those, the way those arcs work, is that, so, for example, a big part of this season, you know, sort of like if you've watched season two, you'll understand that at this point, Kendall is like in a position where he is kind of digging up the dirty laundry has been dug up about this company. And he is, in his mind, doing what he thinks is the right thing. He's standing up for the abused and he's going to bring his dad. He's not really doing it for that. Like, all of these ideas that they've got that you think is going to make this character redeemable all comes from a root of like corruption and power and like the absolute like destruction that capitalism brings. And I fucking love it because as a show, it is the ultimate like fuck you to capitalism and sort of like how massive kind of corporations destroy the people within it and every sort of tendril that it touches. Like, sweet Greg is now awful. Everything about Greg is awful.
I can't remember the phrase used, but like him desperately, like, actually thinking that being the top of the middle to the bottom of the top is like a meaningful change in his life and like how good that would be.
I won't say why it's happening, but there's like a plot line in this season about Greg trying to sue Greenpeace.
And
it's
such
a wonderful like encapsulation of that character.
It's so funny. Every time that comes back, you've forgotten that he's suing Greenpeace and he'll mention it to someone else.
Just those, everyone has their one thing they bring up that, like, every time they mention, I just laugh. It's the same with Tom. Anytime he mentions the prison blogs, I just laugh.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. Yeah. Don't worry, we haven't spoiled anything.
I think another award you could give to Succession in this show is, like, most interesting plot lines done completely off screen. Like, the number of things that happen in Succession that you never see.
Yep.
Like, everything down to, like, what the fuck has happened to Sandy in this series? Like, there's a character who is in the first series and he pops up very briefly in the second, and in this series, he's in a very different state for reasons that you're just never told about. Mm-hmm. And it gives, like, this, like, texture to this world and, like, that there are things going on behind the scenes that you don't get to see. They're so cool.
It's the best thing on television, but I think quite
it's
a distance.
Unbelievable.
Like, for me. Like,
it's wild.
I can't wait for it to come back. And did you have any contenders, any runners-up for this award, Matt? Was there anyone you were...
I mean, there's not another... That's the thing that I love about it so much, is it's completely... It has this conviction about the sort of story it wants to tell and the sort of characters exploring. And it never once gives into the idea of, like, well, we need someone for the audience to root for. It's like, no, there's not a single person. And I love that, like, Jesse Armstrong is so, like, sticks to his guns on that. And obviously he's had, like, experience, like, because obviously he wrote some stuff for the thick of it, which, again, largely is a group of characters of which none of them are really redeemable.
Well, similar with Peep Show, they're not good people.
Similar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just love that, like, he's almost taken that to, like, the extreme that it can be, where you're dealing with what are essentially the Murdochs, right? Like, it's a parody of kind of that side of the media and the families. And just the fact that this one goes, there's a lot to do with power above their stations in this kind of season. And I just love what an unflinching examination it is of that world, while also still being like, it's a genuinely hilarious show. There are points in this where I've laughed more than most comedies, even though literally one of its main character actors doesn't realise he's acting in a comedy. Like, it runs that balance so well.
It's absolute genius. Like, when I was considering a sword, I was thinking, oh, maybe Suicide Squad, because they're sure, not nice people. Like, and that's a film that took me by surprise this year that I enjoyed far more than I thought I would. But yeah, actually links to my award if we're moving on to that. I had another runner-up for that one, which would have been The White Lotus, which is full of horrible people, but was also an incredible TV show, and that is a runner-up for my award for murder mystery that actually worked, that I actually worked out and made me feel like a genius. I'll tell you why the White Lotus isn't winning that, because I didn't work it out and I didn't feel like a genius. That is
what the fuck is it a runner-up then?
Because it's, because it's a murder mystery that was very, very good and
did half of the job.
If you didn't watch The White Lotus, the twist on the murder mystery, and that is right at the start of that show, you're told someone has died. So it's not, you're not working out who the murderer is, you're spending this whole series working out which one of these people on this holiday resort is going to die. So it's kind of a
the
reverse.
The mystery is who is murdered.
Yeah, it is one of the best bits of television this year. Also a just an unlikable like cast of characters, all like, again, quite a damning portrait of capitalism and sort of white entitlement. And it's just, it's funny, it's like a really biting satire, but it's also a good mystery at its core, which I really enjoyed. But yeah, I didn't work that one out, so it's not going to win. One I did actually work out, which I actually binged this past weekend, was Only Murders in the Building, which is on Disney Plus. I was lukewarm on it. I thought it wrapped up for it. It's got a very funny finale. So if you don't know what Only Murders in the Building is, it is Steve Martin doing his first thing in a good few years. And it's always good to have Steve Martin back. You've got Martin Short and Selena Gomez, which is an unlikely team up. But they all live in this big New York apartment building, and there's been a murder in that building. And these three people all listen to the same true crime murder podcast, so they think, do you know what, we're gonna start our own one and try and solve this murder. And it's a it's mainly a comedy. It's quite lighthearted, it's quite easy watching. Like, it's not like a big like true crime murder like show. It's a comedy drama, but it's also got a good mystery at its core. For parts of it, I was a bit like, can we, like, it's 10 episodes, only half an hour each, but I was a bit like, we could have done this quicker. It's a little bit meandering at times, and I did work it out in the end who I thought it was, but it was less, it wasn't that satisfying, because it was more like, I think it's this person because otherwise I don't know why they're in this show, rather than it was like neatly breadcrumbed throughout. Like, I don't think it's a great murder mystery, but it's a very enjoyable program, so it's not winning. But the one that is winning is Mayor of Easttown, which came out quite a bit earlier this year, the Kate Winslet-led murder mystery drama set in, is it Delco, I think, in Philadelphia? No, Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia. Just unbelievably harrowing television. I loved it. It is the opposite of Only Murders in the Building. Like, there are a few laughs in it, but it's a very gritty, dark murder mystery about this small town. It's, I think at the time, a lot of people compared it, and quite, you know, it's a reasonable comparison to an American Broadchurch, if you watch Broadchurch on ITV, I think that was on. It's just very good. And I still remember the night before the finale aired, I texted a friend of the podcast, Lucy James, who was watching at the same time, with my theory. And then when it aired, and I got it like 98% spot on, I felt so clever. And that's why, not only is this a good television program, I don't know what that accent was.
That's the audience, South Africa podcast. Look,
I can do a better South African than that, but I'm not doing that now. Look, I'm off now. I'm coming in to do this podcast. I'm in holiday mode. But
coming
yeah.
in. You're sitting in the same fucking bedroom as you've sat in all year. I'm not having this coming in.
Look, I just watched Moana. I'm on a high right now.
That's exactly what you do normally during the week. You're always watching Moana
all day, every day. But yeah, the reason Mayor of Easttown's winning is not because it is an incredible piece of television, but because it made me feel clever, and that's what's important. I needed that this year.
But it genuinely is nice to see a murder mystery with a conclusion that you can work out,
yes,
like through puzzle deduction. Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many TV shows that don't allow you that. And that, I'm not saying they're worse,
yeah,
but they're just a different thing. But I do love those ones where it's like, this is something you can do. Like, I had it was nowhere near as good, but I watched Netflix's The Chestnut Man this year and worked that out ahead of time. And it was like, oh, that's fucking cool. It gives you those pieces.
That's the problem with Only Murders in the Building, I think, is that it kind of, it's not really doing that. Like, from the second episode, you'd have no clue who did this. But, like, it's more just, like, eight episodes of complete red herrings that are not linked to the case. You're just like, well, that was kind of, like, I don't really have a chance here, if you know what I mean. But yeah, Mare of Easttown, if you haven't watched it, do it.
Here's one you can skip if you have been lucky enough not to see it. I've got an award. I'm calling it the K-Pax Memorial Award for movie most plausibly made by aliens. A runner-up, which I've just thought of, is The Matrix Resurrections.
Oh,
I don't know whether
Lord.
We will have discussed it on this podcast by the time you hear it, but that film doesn't feel like it was made by humans. But the winner of this award for me is Venom, Let There Be Carnage, which I think might be one of the worst films I've ever seen in the cinema.
And you've seen Matrix Resurrections this year.
And I've seen Matrix Resurrections and Mr. Deeds, which... No, not Mr. Deeds. That's the Adam Sandler one. What's the Jeremy Piven one where he's like some sort of dickhead? Anyway.
Entourage?
I can't remember.
He's one in that, isn't he? I don't know.
Someone will write in. It's fucking... That is actually the worst film I've
ever
seen.
I'm going to find it now.
But Venom, Let There Be Carnage gives it a run for its money by being a film in which literally none of the dialogue rings true. None of the acting feels like it was performed with any sense of knowing where the end of the scene was. The plot is held together by fucking carnage goo. And, like, it's honestly one of... It makes no sense to me that any intelligent person was involved with making that film at any point. Like, the best and most coherent bit of it is the post-credit scene where it just goes, by the way, Venom's going to be in the MCU, fuck off. or might as well. I haven't actually seen Spider-Man while we're talking, but I'm assuming that's what it's communicating. And I'm telling you that's the most coherent bit of this film.
It's you say it's made by... you can't believe humans made this. Like, we're lucky
it's made
enough
by
to...
Andy Serkis.
No, we're lucky enough to have met him. Lovely, very intelligent man. What's he doing?
It feels like Andy Serkis was either, like... stepped on by studio committee bullshit or had some sort of massive brain event while he was making this, because I don't understand how you could come out of this movie feeling anything other than like a deep regret for everything you've done for the past
six. Do you think he was taking like the
work?
Planet the Apes stuff too far and he directed it as an ape? He was thinking, how would an ape make a film?
This could be Caesar's first movie, because I can't express to you how much I hated every second of this movie.
I am yet to see it.
I really didn't mind Venom 1. Like, I didn't think it was good, but I didn't mind it. I watched it. Its mixture of comedy and seriousness didn't quite gel for me, but it, like, did plot point A to plot point B to plot point C. This film makes no fucking sense. Like, there's a bit where Carnage, like... plugs into a computer, or it plugs into the internet and like works out where a secret lab is. And it's like, at no point have we ever learned that a fucking alien symbiote is also internet literate through like whatever his like jism arm is that he can stick into stuff. It's fucking
And that's
rubbish.
Woody Harrelson, right?
Also, it doesn't help that, yeah, it is. And also, it doesn't help that I saw this literally the day after I got engaged. It's like I had the best day of my life, and then the next day.
that should have been a treat, because wasn't Venom 1 one of your fiancé's favourite films that year? She loved
it. Anna really likes Venom 1. So, basically, the next day I was like, right.
Here's the treat now.
As a final part of the engagement, we can go and see Venom 2. And even Anna didn't like it. It's an absolute fucking disaster of a movie. It's awful. And, like, not in a good way. Like, I'm recommending that people watch Matrix Resurrections just to see what the fuck they've done to that franchise. I can't say the same for Venom 2. It is fucking abominable. Don't bother.
The only thing that I've seen of Venom 2 that... I had to go and ask people, is this actually a legitimate screen grab from the film or is this a Photoshop? Is Venom apparently goes to like an LGBT rave?
Yes. And who's that? There's a new famous rapper lady who's in it. I can't remember her name. She's very famous.
Megan
Thee
Stallion? I'm just thinking of any new... newish,
no, she's
big
a, she's
female
from
rappers.
London. I can't remember her name.
From London.
I'm not cool enough. But there's a bit where like Venom just takes the mic from her and gives a speech about like finding himself. It's very, very misconceived. Like, the whole... like, and that's... oh, my God. There's just so much wrong with it. Like, it's a film so bad it makes Stephen Graham bad, and I genuinely can't think of a single bad Stephen Graham role in, like, the history of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, he's... it, he cut, like, it feels like he's, like, recoiling from the camera in every scene because of what he's having to say.
I mean,
it's
you've...
gross.
All of them have got to make money somehow, I imagine.
Oh, fucking hell. But, yeah. This is it. It's going to be Stephen Graham's biggest payday of his entire career, and good on him for that. But fuck me, I hope he doesn't have to come back and do it anymore, because Jesus.
I won't be watching that really one, bad. I don't think. Yeah.
Right. I believe everything after this is positive. I've got that out of my system. I didn't get to talk about it at the time. It's gone. Matt, bring us back up.
So my next one is the best reaction to all this award.
right.
Which is for Bo Burnham's Inside.
Yes.
Which, one of my most listened to albums of the year, but obviously originally is a Netflix comedy special. That I really liked at the time, and we did discuss it on the podcast at the time, but has just only kind of like increased in my favour as time has gone, and as I've just like listened over and over to those kind of songs and kind of like mined them for kind of like the hidden depths to it. And kind of it's weird, like in linking to Succession, Succession is very much like a damning sort of like look at what the world is today through a very funny lens. Of which quite a lot of Inside basically does that. It's a man that sat, you know, obviously not in that room, because that room is clearly not where Bo Burnham lives on the amount of fat stacks he's got. But having to live, like, inside for a long time and obviously just be able to think about how you're going to frame an awful lot of issues through the lens of comedy, to the point where it's... and it's, like, it's both self-reflection and reflection of the rest of the world. And it's so funny the way he does it, but it really, like, hits true in a way that kind of does have, like, a sting in the tail that's just like, oh, some of this is actually really quite sad and profound, but also, like, incredibly joyful at the same time. And I think we, obviously, for the actual main awards, had to vote for who we thought was best director. I actually put Bo Burnham in for this over Denis Villeneuve. And obviously, I really like Dune, and I think Dune is incredibly well directed. But I have not seen a comedy special that's like Inside, and I think it's such like an incredible thing to produce out of a time of great kind of turmoil. Just like, I really, like, as a piece of creative work, I incredibly admire this. Like, I love it so much.
It's unbelievable. I think the week it came out, I watched it at least three times. Like, I know you can just put the album on, but I was thinking, anytime I was thinking of putting the album on, I was like, oh, I might as well just put the actual Netflix thing on. But yeah, it's so good. Like, yeah, you've got me wanting to watch it again now. It's genius. And just the Jeffrey Bezos song for me comes into my head all the time. Like, it's so short in comparison to that whole thing, but I just found it very funny. And I'm also having the sudden realization that I will soon also be turning 30 in about 2.5 months. And yeah, I'm going to have that moment that he had, and I will almost definitely watch that the night I become 30 and really relish in all melancholy available.
You know, turning 30 is like, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I know. I don't really care, but he made me care. He made me care.
That's a bit that annoyed me in that, because I was just like, oh, fuck, grow up. Like, come on, mate. Like, there's bigger problems that you are talking about. The 30 thing.
No, it's all right. It could have been the end. But yeah, it's absolutely genius. I don't think there's much more to say about it than that. Than it's one of the best things of this year.
I can't believe that was this year. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's been a long one. I've got an award now for...
go.
The award for... so, we've, like, it's linked to Inside. We've been basically, you know, not stuck inside for almost 2 years now, but, you know, not really be able to go anywhere. And one of the things I love most in this world is to travel. And top of my list of places is to go to New York, probably. I've only ever been to New York for a day before. And I want to do a proper trip to New York. So, this award is the film or TV show that I would most want to visit in New York. Visit New York in it.
Right.
Okay. So, not necessarily the best thing that was set in New York, but the one where I watched it, I was like, I'd like to be there right now.
Yeah.
So this is a stacked category, I will tell you that. Runners-up, Succession. Not a lot of this season actually set in New York. I also wouldn't want to be part of their world. That's not winning.
No.
Number two, West Side Story. One of the best films of the year. Their depiction of New York, though, it's not an area and a time of New York I want to be at. It's not the 50s Mad Men New York. It's the other side of New York. I don't want to be a part of Rumbles. Number three, In the Heights. This was a runner-up. Very close runner-up. In the Heights, another New York set musical that came out this year. Bit too hot for me. Very hot in that film.
Sticky.
Very hot. I'm not dealing with that. Last runner-up, Spider-Man No Way Home. I think we'll do a full spoiler of that at some point, so I'll keep it brief. I very much enjoyed this film, but you know, bit much going on in the city at the time in this film. Bit dangerous for me. I don't want to be there.
All superhero film New Yorks are like absolute death traps.
My winner, though, you say that, my winner, Hawkeye. Christmas in New York. What more do you want? I wanna go and see the giant Christmas tree. I'm steering clear of, you know, the tracksuit gang, whatever, the tracksuit mafia,
yeah.
Steering clear of all that, all the arrows and the swords. I'm just going to have a nice time and look at that big tree. So yeah, my winner is, basically this is me saying I wish I was in New York right now.
At Christmas, yeah.
But yeah, I've just really been enjoying Hawkeye. By the time this is out, the finale will be out. We're recording this the day before the finale. It's been, I think, a mixed year for Marvel TV shows. I'd have Hawkeye currently as my second favourite. I've enjoyed it a lot. We'll see how it wraps up. I still actually have WandaVision as my favourite. I didn't necessarily like the way that ended, but I just enjoyed the ride the most. I think I liked what it was doing with all the like referential comedy stuff throughout history. And then Loki. I still enjoyed Loki, but I've just enjoyed Hawkeye that bit more. Falcon and the Winter Soldier, was poor.
Dog shit.
Hawkeye wins for place I'd most like to be right now, basically.
I think, like, Hawkeye's general niceness is exactly why I'm enjoying it. I think it's the best Marvel show. Like, WandaVision really shat the bed for me. I just thought the end, like, did away with a lot of the goodwill I had from the start.
Yeah.
I need to go back and check it out. But the Hawkeye small-scale thing feels like the best possible so far. We'll see what they do with the final episode. Like the best possible mix of like how do you do that ground level thing the Netflix series were trying to do, but give them a bit more impetus, like a bit more connectivity, and like some of that sort of connective tissue that makes Marvel stuff feel really exciting to a big nerd. And I'm really enjoying that.
It's come out at a perfect time as well, because you've got that ground of stuff, and then if you want the big MCU blowout cataclysmic events, you've got Spider-Man in the cinema, which is doing the much bigger ideas sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they're almost in direct opposition, right? Because the thing I really like about Hawkeye is it's not trying to move the Marvel Cinematic Universe anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes it's nice to, you know, both in the comics and in the MCU at large, it's just nice to get a story that's about that character rather than about what multiversal importance, you know, these events have. And like, it's a show that is both about a man trying to get over his trauma and grief and kind of work out sort of like how to repair himself. But the way that's done feels so naturalistic that it's almost like in the background of what's actually like a really fun, just joyous duo like partnership. I think it's, the more I think about it, which obviously I'm having to, because if anybody doesn't know, I review Hawkeye for the site and I'm currently putting together my thoughts for what I think of the show as a whole. There's actually a lot of big ideas in Hawkeye, but it never like self-inflates its own grandeur. So you have to dig a bit to find that. But when you find it, like, it does do some smart stuff. It just never shouts about it in the way that like Falcon and the Winter Soldier is a very shouty show about how much like it's all these lofty ambitions it has about race and America's position in the world and kind of, you know, refugees and terrorism and stuff like that. And Hawkeye has its own bigger ideas, but the way it just kind of knows that they don't need to get in the way of it just being a fun superhero movie set at Christmas in New York.
Yeah, it's just very, very nice, very enjoyable. Still not sure if people, like, some people will be waiting until the whole thing's out. You may have watched it, so I don't want to spoil it, but last couple episodes have been particularly good, I think. And even though I don't have as much connection to the characters they're revealing and stuff and adding to it recently. It's made me want to go back, and I'm trying to say this as cryptically as possible, go back and watch what I previously missed. So yeah, it's very good. And yeah, maybe next year I'll be in in New York for Christmas. That'll be nice.
Well, from Hawkeye, which I believe is a one series deal, to another one series deal, definitively. this is the best TV show at making me nostalgic for something I have actually quite little fondness for, which is Midnight Mass, a film all about being a big old Catholic.
Oh, we have very similar categories here. This is going to be a big, like, I have not got Midnight Mass as a winner, but I'm sorry if you are devoutly Catholic. That's all I'll say.
So I grew up Catholic. I am less so now. But I did the whole deal. I was an altar boy. I did all the big processions.
You drank
the
blood of Christ. Yeah.
I drank a lot of blood of the Christ. Yeah. And it's all real. It's all real if you're a Catholic. It's real blood. And I carried the candles, and I did the Thurifer stuff, which is swinging the incense about.
That's
all
too
those
much.
Things.
Yeah.
I was proper into it. I say into it, I was proper in a family that was into it.
And then you found Dynasty Warriors.
And Dynasty Warriors changed everything, and I became a Shintoist. I don't even know if there's any Shintoism in Dynasty Warriors. But Midnight Mass is a show that doesn't just like revel in the details of Catholicism, but like sort of wallows in them and uses them as big ways to get its horror story across. And like, not in a wholly negative way. Like, it would be very easy to watch this show. Like, my dad, who is still a practicing Catholic, watched and enjoyed all of Midnight Mass. Like, he didn't come away from it feeling attacked by it in any way. It's just sort of a rumination on what that religion is and does in a lot of ways. But the stuff that really got to me while I was watching it was like, Flanagan has clearly like either been a part of that culture himself or has done a lot of research into it. I haven't actually checked. And like, there's tiny details that feel so redolent to me. And I'm like, why am I thinking about when they changed the Eucharist translations, which is a thing I remember in my life. And like, I remember there actually being minor controversies over that, like, because they changed some words in the Mass. And they mention it, and like, something about that really just hit me immediately. And it's that like very personal connection to incredible mundanity that I think works so well at giving you the sense that this community is like not a group of people in a horror story. They're a group of real people, and a horror story has come to their town, and you're watching like the effects swirl through them. And I just like, it's such a, it doesn't matter if you don't know those references, and it doesn't matter if those things mean nothing to you. But it does make a huge difference if you get them. And I think that's the perfect way of like dropping that kind of cultural touchstone into a show. And I just like, that's part of what made Midnight Mass sing for me so much. Like, it gave it this sense of realism and connectivity and interest that I've not seen other shows deal with, other than shows about the problems or good things about those things. It's not about Catholicism and the Catholic Church. But it kind of is.
It's about religion as a whole, like, really. Like, it uses Catholicism as its base. But yeah, it's kind of like about just humans, beliefs, what they will believe. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. Like, when it first came out, I thought, this is very, very good. I wasn't quite as high on it. The more I thought about it, though, I do just think it's his best thing now. Although, like, the more I thought about it, the more I've watched things about it, the more I've seen it dissected, I just kind of want to watch it again now. It's just amazing.
If you're interested in like the religion side of things, like, there's a really good personal essay on IGN by Jared Petty that's about like his own religion and how he felt it reflected in Midnight Mass. And I think that says a lot of stuff more eloquently than I just have. But even if you don't care about that stuff, it's a really fucking good horror show. Like, it's not a particularly scary horror show. It's just a really good old-fashioned horror story. and it uses that stuff to propel itself so beautifully.
Exactly. It's an I think we're being show. Deliberately coy. If you haven't watched it, don't want it to be revealed what the true horror of the truth of it
is a big
but
part
I know
of
that's
it.
A big part of why Matt loved it.
Yeah, like there's, you know, it's a show that, because I originally tuned in expecting it to be, I guess, something closer to The Exorcist and the idea of kind of like where it kind of put its horror vibes into a religious kind of setting, and it's not. What it does links into an interest I have in the Catholic Church and where certain ideas are kind of paralleled in other elements of horror. And so for me, that kind of reveal, like, happens, what, about a third of the way into the show, maybe?
And yeah, it's like end of episode two, start of episode three.
Yeah, very much took me from a show that I'd become more interested in from a dramatic standpoint to I'm now full in on it being a horror show, and I adore... There's almost a slightly Del Toro element to kind of where it goes with that, which I think is absolutely, like, incredible. It also, like... It's been sort of mentioned that it's a very monologue-y show. I never noticed that all the way through it, just because of how organically it manages to build what effectively are monologuing characters into a show that is very much about kind of like people investing in other people and like unburdening themselves of their problems. And sort of like, you know, a certain segment of it is to do with a character that has an alcohol issue. Well, that involves talking to someone, and it allows these beautiful monologues to come out that never feel like a Tarantino kind of setup where you've just got a character barking to camera. It feels like so natural and so kind of like beautifully organic as part of the show. It's like incredibly well constructed.
It's also that Flanagan knows how to shoot a monologue. Mm-hmm. Like, so many people would just put it on someone's face and zoom in. And like, some of those, particularly those AA scenes where you have two people, it's not a dialogue, it's two monologues going on in tandem. And like, the way he shoots those things and like odd compositions that feel like something in that room is wrong, but it's not showing you what's wrong in it. Like, just amazing choices all the way through. Yeah. I will also say, if Hamish Linklater was my priest, I'd probably still be Catholic. Yeah. That guy could fucking
I was about to mention, yeah. Like, I think he was only second. He won our performance of the year at IGN in a TV show. He was only second to Kate Winslet for me. Like, yeah, he was and I had not seen him in anything else. Like, before that, I did not know who he was, but yeah, unbelievable performance. Yeah,
he's watch so good.
Midnight Mass. Only 7 episodes as well, undone on Netflix. So yeah,
it's amazing.
Always good. I like a bit of Christmas horror as well. Like, normally a ghost story, but this kind of will serve that for you, I think.
I think it fits a bill. I think it fits a bill. Matt, your final category.
Final category. Best TV show that's actually a set of movies goes to Netflix's Fear Street, both 1994, 1978, and 1666. I love that this is that it works almost like a television show. It, like, the way it was released was a weekly release. You got a film each new weekend. They all fit together to tell a single sort of story, but it never feels like a trilogy of movies that kind of have their own kind of distinct standalone elements. They feel as a whole. I'm not actually the biggest fan of 1666. I think the first half of 1666 is actually bad.
Yep.
But as a whole that comes together, I think this was a really great, like, gamble, I suppose, to a degree, a little bit of a gamble by Netflix to make three movies and just assume that it's going to work. Well,
that's the weird thing. Because I kind of, when I did watch, I watched it all like week after week. I was like, this almost would have been better as 6 episodes, like if they'd cut it even further in half, I think, and done it like that.
I almost think, I definitely think for myself, if they'd released it that way, I probably wouldn't have watched it. But the fact that it had like this bizarre
event style.
Like, yeah, like the fact that it was an event and the fact that I'd never heard of anything like it made me go, oh, I'll probably give that a go. Like, let's see one of these things and see. And that's all it needs to hook you, really. And I agree with Matt. Like, I don't think as a whole, like, the story is an unqualified success, but I'm really glad it exists because I love, I think we've even, I'm not sure whether we talked about this in real life or here, but like, I love that Netflix and other streaming services are allowing experiments like this to happen. Like, take the form and fuck around with it. Like when you first found out that, I think it was House of Cards was the first one where it was like, this episode's an hour, but this episode's half an hour. Like they're not sticking themselves to arbitrary advertising related limits on time. So you have this sense of like everything works for the story first and foremost. And I love that it's still doing things with that.
Yeah. I think the second part was easily my favorite of the three. I loved that one. That was the Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I actually prefer 1984. I really like the Scream sort of element of those. And, you know, to the point where I'm fairly sure that the music in that one is done by the composer that does Scream. And I like that because it almost is a bit of a Scream homage, it sets up this idea of scary movies and the tropes of different horrors kind of then threading through this universe that... I really like the almost tonal conflict of it. It takes its universe really seriously, but it presents it very, very goofily. Mm-hmm. And I love the way it does that. And it's why I have a problem with 1666. I think it takes kind of a genre that's not very easily kind of spoofed and takes itself way too seriously to a point where
it's trying to be the witch, that bit. And you can't try and be the witch. You can't do that.
And I don't actually think some of the stuff it's trying to do as the witch actually makes sense for the rest of the show.
I know they need to do it for the story, but I almost think, God, you could have done that in 5 or 10 minutes. Just told us that story very quickly.
I would much rather that the 1666 stuff was told as a flashback rather than sort of presented as half a movie and then you get another half a movie at the end.
It was odd.
But I agree with you, like the Friday the 13th stuff I think is done very, very well. And I like that it goes, when it wants to go all out, this set of films goes all out.
There's
a wonderful kill in 1994.
I know exactly the one you mean. That one fucked me up. I hated it.
It's so good. But I think 1994 has more of the, like, it makes those set pieces where it's like a single kind of moment. Whereas the second one, it just goes ham with that axe. It's just very, very happily smacking people up. And it, just that joyful kind of, you know, it's obviously based on the R.L. Stine books and they're not one-to-one translations of those books. But it does such a good job of holding that vibe of what that author brings to horror, kind of very much. None of the ideas in any of R.L. Stine books are his own. They're all kind of aping off, you know, movies and things that he's seen. But it puts his spin on it. And I think they bring that to life so well in this, while also making them very modern horror. Sort of like, you know, there's a little bit of LGBT in there. There's kind of like, you know, women are kind of like a key part of it. And I think all of that kind of fitted together in a package that I just found like such a cool experimental vibe and that TV show sort of aspect that worked, you know, as well as it did. I really hope that I don't need to see another Fear Street, but I would like to see Netflix do another thing where like, yeah, we've made a trilogy of movies and you're going to get them, you know, one weekend after another.
Yeah. Very enjoyable. Very enjoyable watch. My last award is kind of a bit similar to Joe's last one. In fact, Midnight Mass is my runner-up. This is the things I previously avoided, like the plague, but this show hooked me anyway. So yeah, Midnight Mass is the runner-up of the Catholic Church. I don't tend to get involved in much of that. I've seen Spotlight. But the winner is Arcane for League of Legends. League of Legends, anytime I see it, does absolutely nothing for me. The game itself, that is. Like, noted K-pop fan and KDA fan. Love basically everything they do outside of League of Legends, but with those characters in that world. Still no desire to play the actual game itself, but Arcane, one of the biggest surprises for me of the year. Still can't believe how good the animation and the music. Like, shouldn't really doubt Riot at this point, but just transported me into that world, knowing nothing of it before, instantly knew everyone, what was going on, like, incredible world building, and I just, like, season 2 of Arcane is one of my most anticipated things now.
And again, like, structurally super brave, like, it does stuff with how that story's told that's, like, very, very cool and very interesting and different, and I'm in exactly the same places you like. League of Legends does absolutely nothing for me, and I have actively laughed at how shit its lore is before, and somehow they've turned that into one of the most compelling animated shows of the year. Like, and you know, I say it as a huge Castlevania fan, like, gives Castlevania a massive run for its money as, like, best video game adaptation I've seen. It's fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a cool show.
Yeah.
And what a great idea.
I mean, we talked about it loads only like a month or two ago, so I won't talk too much about it. But yeah, if you still haven't given Arcane a go, I think you'll be instantly hooked. It's like, it's only 10 episodes. They're like half an hour long each as well. They're not too long, I don't think. Like, yeah, it's just, I think up there is, and bear in mind, I just watched Moana, one of the best animations I've ever seen, especially once it gets really into like the first three episodes, very good, but once it does a little time skip ahead, then it really hits its stride, and I just wanted more and more.
Mm-hmm. Just less Imagine Dragons in the next one.
Do you know what?
I don't need them to appear.
That should have been my award.
I don't need their music to be in it.
That should have been my award, the thing that actually made Imagine Dragons bearable.
I don't think they're bearable because the skip button got some liberal use.
I watched the intro every time, but mainly because I liked the animation.
Did you spot, like, the guy from Imagine Dragons is in it,
oh,
isn't
of course,
he?
I know,
yeah.
It's fucking irritating.
Yeah, there's no need for that. Can people stop doing that? Like, when we put Ed Sheeran in Game of Thrones, let's just stop that. Let's just stop doing that.
Yeah, we should have stopped after Nick Cage in The Assassination of Jesse James. That's the last time it's allowed to have happened.
Do you mean Nick Cave or Nick Cage?
Nick Cave, not Nick Cage. Obviously, that'd be insane.
That would have somehow made that film even better if Nicolas Cage was in it. Oh my word. I think next week, actually, a little tease is our look forward to 2022 episode, and I mentioned it briefly there, but have you guys seen the new Nicolas Cage film trailer?
I have not seen the trailer yet. I'm excited by the concept of it.
Do you know the concept of the film, Matt?
No clue.
It's called, I've forgotten the name now. It's The Impossible Weight.
It's The Unbearable Weight of Incredible Talent or something.
Yeah. It's a film basically where Pedro Pascal is a millionaire who hires Nicolas Cage, who is playing a version of himself, to come to his party and perform scenes from some of his most iconic roles for him. And things go wrong.
Okay.
It's going to be good. I'm telling you now, it's going to be good. Almost as good as Bullet Train. And you'll hear more about that next week.
I'm excited about that. I love the fact that Nick Cage's latter career has become like a warped meta version of Liam Neeson's change into an action star.
Yeah.
Like, Nick Cage has done the same thing, except it's all about him. It's not about action films. It's Nick Cage plays a series of roles in which he is Nick Cage.
I haven't seen Pig yet, which came out this year, which a lot of people genuinely say is one of the best films of the year. I do need to watch that, because when Nicolas Cage is good, he is genuinely good. He's not just a joke.
He's a frightening paintbrush of an actor. he's wonderful. Right. Was that your one, Cardi?
That is mine, yes.
I forgot what we were talking about. That was Arcane.
Yeah, it's just the last one.
We don't often talk about comedy on this podcast because
we're funny enough
to talk about. Yeah. Funny enough, comedies these days, fucking go woke, go broke. You know what I mean?
Jesus Christ.
The comedy that I don't think I've given any or enough time to talking about on here is the winner of my award for the highest number of lines that have utterly infected my waking life, which I give to I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson, which season two came out this year. Season one, like, just destroyed my ability to communicate with some people because I only talk in lines from season one.
Yeah.
And season two did exactly the same thing again. So my vocabulary with some people is just shouting stuff at them. And so I just thought I'd write down a series of lines from I Think You Should Leave season two that I will never have leave my head.
Go ahead.
So I've got, "What a crop!" which I say about anything when it's good.
Okay, good.
"They said that to me at a dinner!" is another one that I say a lot. A sadder one. "There's too much fucking shit on me."
I've never heard you say any of these. I might try and trigger these from you.
You don't watch it.
I don't watch it. I mean, the only time I've watched this was actually like E3 2019 when it was us three actually, and we'd come back from the IGN E3 party all quite lubricated, and probably at like 2 a.m. ordered massive cheeseburgers and watched that episode with the baby contest in it or whatever. That's the only memory I have of this.
I have no memory of this. So I watched the first season. Oh, I think you should leave. Like 2 weeks ago, I had no memory that I'd ever come into contact with it before.
Well, you were very well lubricated, sir.
I'm just going to push through. I'm scared about how much I need wine, which is something that I definitely think anyway.
That's a good line.
That's not slicked back, that's pushed back about hair is a good one.
I do that a lot.
You gotta give is another one that I say to people.
is that a good line?
Yeah, you have to see it. This is the point.
Okay.
And then finally, a longer one. If I were a farmer and Eddie Munster came in and started kicking my corn, you would understand how I could be a bit upset.
That show is
the best comedy show. It's the best sketch show since Limmy's show, which is just astonishingly good. Tim Robinson just has this amazing ability as a person to just say one phrase over and over again in a really strange way until you can't get it out of your head. Like the other day he appeared on a clip from Tim Heidecker, does a podcast called Office Hours, and he just turned up in the audience of it and called everything Tim Heidecker had ever done in his career a cash grab. But he would just say, "That's a cash grab." And he just says it over and over again until it doesn't matter what Tim Heidecker says back to him. You know he's going to somehow turn it into a cash grab, and it's fucking hilarious.
Maybe I need to give it a proper good go.
It's the best. It's so good, man. And you can do it all in 2 hours. Like, they're 10-minute episodes or 15-minute episodes. It's so good. I love it.
There we go.
Those are our awards for the year.
Yeah, sorry, June.
June.
Good.
Boring ending award.
Oh, come on.
The end.
That's outrageous behaviour.
Okay. One last award. Just a bookend with something horrible. If you've got any alternative movie or TV awards or games ones, if you've listened to the other episode, email them to us, IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com. We might make our first feedback section of the year a bunch of alternative awards. Why not that? I would love to hear what strange ways you have to connect to things that you've enjoyed. I don't know if there's anything else to say. I'm freaking out that we haven't done the Endless Search, but we don't do that on these.
No, because there's no feedback just because, we haven't got a lot of time, I'm afraid. No. It's almost Christmas. I just hope you have but this is going out Christmas Eve. Everyone have a lovely Christmas.
Oh, my God. Why haven't we been putting sleigh bells in the background the whole time? Jesse, retrospectively put sleigh bells over everything we've just said.
Is Jesse editing this? I thought I was. That's a result if I'm not editing this.
Oh, I believe it's Jesse doing it.
Is it? Oh, fantastic.
It shouldn't be you.
Oh, good.
If Jesse is hearing this, sorry. I didn't realise there was any confusion. Right. With that, let's go and drink a big cup of mulled pine. Bye.
Yeah, see ya.
Bye.
Hello, this is Editor Jesse, coming to you live from Google Translate. Hope you enjoyed the sleigh bells, but most importantly, happy holidays. Muahahahahahahahaha.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.